and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you so much for joining me today, as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, so my name's Alison Cummins and I am a midwife. I've been a midwife for over 30 years. And for the last 10 years, I have worked full-time in academia. And early in that time, I undertook a PhD.
So in that time beforehand, getting into academia, what made you do that shift from clinical to academia?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I was working in clinical midwifery practice, so I'd worked in all sorts of models of care, but mostly continuity of care. And when I was a new graduate, I applied for a job in the very new team midwifery, which was the only continuity of care model in Australia at the time. And I didn't get the job because they said I didn't have enough experience. So I went off and I did, I worked in a birth centre with really inspiring and, you know, philosophically promotion of normal physiological birth midwives. And I had a great time there. And then I really wanted to support midwifery students. So I could see that they were being, you know, institutionalized and not actually getting the. So I did a master's in adult education, and I became a midwifery educator in the clinical setting. And during that time, which I worked in that role for 8 years, I was often invited to, as a guest lecturer to the unis. And then a whole shift in team midwifery. I was part of supporting the Mango trial at one of the sites. And my brief as a midwifery educator was to transfer 32 full-time equivalent midwives from rostered shifts or team midwifery into caseload, full MGP. So I did that, and that what I noticed was the only way we could do it, just because of the demographics of midwives. You know, a lot of them have families, work part-time, are older. The ones who were really keen were the new graduates. And so I supported them, and I noticed that they were actually fine. They'd ring you up and say, oh, so this woman's wrong me, and she told me this and this and this and this, and I gave her that advice. What do you reckon? I go, yep, that's the right advice. So I mentored them. So at that point I approached I found a supervisor, Professor Caroline Homer, and I said to her, you know, I want to do a study on mentoring new graduates into continuity of care. And then I was just about to enrol in that, and then they invited me, you know, I applied for a position, a full-time academic position, and then I was working full-time teaching at the university. And then at do I say what university?
Yeah, absolutely, if you're happy to.
Yeah, at UTS in Sydney. And then I still kept up a little bit of clinical and quite a lot of engagement with women and partners through education, you know, what you call it, childbirth preparation classes. So I kept up my clinical, and I was teaching, and I was doing my PhD, and I was a mother of teenage children. And I do remember my daughter was doing the HSC when I really got stuck into my PhD, and I do remember studying alongside her. So, you know, it's very doable with family, with work, and, yeah, and it was great. So my PhD actually started to explore the experiences of new graduate midwives working in continuity of care. And I found that they were actually very well prepared from their degree and specifically from the continuity of care experiences in their degree. And I feel like, you know, there's been debate about the numbers that students should undertake, and I feel like We really need to protect those experiences because they do prepare them. And a lot of work's come out about that now, recent work from other people as well.
And we've our numbers have just gone down with the last kind of accreditation for continuities as well, because we've gone down to a minimum of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, minimum of 10. I know we've kept it to 15 because five each year for direct entry 3 years. But, yes, 10 nationally.
Yeah, the minimum, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I found that they were mentored, actually. They mm-hmm. either were allocated a mentor or they found their own. And it wasn't always an MGP midwife. Sometimes it was, you know, the labour, the birth unit, night duty, Saturday night duty person who had the most corporate knowledge of the place. So who to call when. So they, you know, they found their mentors. So mentoring is really important. But then I thought, well, hold on. They're saying that they're well prepared to do it. They're well supported. For the midwives who had been doing the traditional kind of rotate through the hospital new grad program, they were saying compared to that, they learnt more. They consolidated their skills and knowledge better when they knew the woman.
Yep.
That relationship with the woman. Yep. Having that relationship with the woman, they found it easier, and they just, you know, things they didn't know was who to call or whatever, and they got support. So they were well supported through mentoring. So then I thought, well, hold on, I can only find 13 in the whole of Australia. So what's the problem? They're all saying it's great. So so I then interviewed managers about the challenges of employing. So there was and my findings from that was that it's hard to change our system of new graduates doing the traditional new grad program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, there's a bit of a myth that they're not, they haven't got enough knowledge and experience to do continuity of care. So they, managers were really having to be myth busters and say, I think it'll be okay. They're doing it here, they're doing it there, this is the way forward. But mostly the driver for doing it was to staff the models.
Mm.
The managers were committed to the models, so they wanted to staff them. So the driver for employing them was to get the new grads in. Then they had to, like, facilitate, through support, so they offered mentoring. And, you know, I just remember one great quote, and that was, give them 3 months and they'll fly. And then, you know, they were great. So a longer orientation period, an initial reduced caseload to begin with, and then after 3 months they were right up there with the NGP midwives who'd been doing it for 5 years. So so that was great. And then I came up with, okay, well, this is what we need to do to make mm-hmm. it happen. So I came up with a conceptual model, because conceptual model has students need to prepare for this. So they need to, you know, do the minimum of 10 or whatever's prescribed, but they need to not just do it, but do it well, like learn from it, engage in continuity of care. They need to seek out positions. So they need to look for a place where they can transition into continuity of care, because some hospitals do offer it. And then for the managers, they need to find students that they think will be a good fit for the group. Yep. They need to put them in the group while they're a student to do some placement with them. And then they also need to provide support when they mm-hmm. transition as a new grad. So if you put all that in the mix, and you have a high level of continuity, there has to be that relationship of trust, not just with the woman, but a relationship of trust with the group. Mm. So there has to be, I could call her anytime, or, you know, if I was worried, I had someone who could help me. And, we would have regular meetings. Regular meetings were important because it kept them connected to the group. And then they also got to know the other women in case they had to be on call for those women. So, yeah, so it was all about relationships in the end.
That comes down to everything, really, isn't it? Primal. Yeah.
And then I think I have been awarded, I received an award for distilling impactful research, because this is happening. This is happening in Queensland. People are using this research to put new graduates into the models. It's happening at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. They're really innovative there. It's happening in Broken Hill in New South Wales. And, you know, other people, it's happening. In fact, someone on Twitter sent me a message this morning from the UK.
Excellent.
I've been using your work to do this. And it's just like, oh, it was so worth it. It was so worth it, because at the end of the day, you want to make a difference. That's why it's so important to do research, is to really make a difference, and make a difference to something that's important to you, and that'll make a difference also to the women. Because if we can't find staff, then we can't have the models, then the women don't get the access. So, yeah.
Okay, a couple of questions that I've got for you now that come from that. Do we actually train midwives to be effective mentors and preceptors?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I like the word educate rather than train.
Old school train, everything's train. It's like, no, educate and facilitate.
Yeah, so I think our education curricula could include more on supporting and mentoring, students and so on. And even maybe that's what the new graduate year needs.
Mm.
And, in fact, I'm going to be doing some work with a partner up at Newcastle, and they want to do a workshop for the midwives to be able to support new graduates to transition in. Yeah. So we probably need to do a bit more work in that area, actually, and that could be a PhD in itself.
Oh, I've undoubtedly kind of, there's so much within that area that there's, as part of our scope of practice of registration, we are expected to be able to precept the students that work with us. And there is such a delicate ground sometimes of the students generally want to know, why are you doing it that way? Because they want to know, they've seen the same thing done in multiple different ways. And yet if you're tired and you're not thinking, you can actually be snappy at the student thinking they're challenging you and trying to test you. It's like, no, they're generally knowledge. So getting the skills and how to respond, I think that's that importance with growing that confidence in those areas as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I should mention is the New Zealand model has excellent mentoring.
Yep.
One of the fundamental and critical differences, I would say, is that the New Zealand new graduate model, which is mentoring into lead maternity care provider, is that it's funded by the government. And I must say, and this is one of the things that I did write in my discussion chapter, is that the funding in New South Wales, I don't know what happens everywhere else, although I do know that in every state in Australia they have a transition to practice program for new graduates.
Mm-hmm.
It's just called different things.
Yep.
And associated with that in New South Wales, and I'm almost certain in other states, is that the health department give funding to the hospital, mm-hmm, to support new graduates. And that kind of funding goes towards skills and drills days, study days, supposed to go to, educator support in ward settings. But we know what happens is that the new graduates are rostered for a study day, but the ward's too busy and they have to stay there and look after their load. And then the other thing that happens is the midwifery educators that are funded by this new graduate transition money actually have to do all the other work of supporting the staff's mandatory education and doing their basic life support skills and their neonatal resuscitation skills. And I feel like the money could be redirected to something similar that's in the New Zealand model.
And there's also this fear of graduates that the only pathway is through, we call it a TPPP, Transition to Professional Practice Program, that they fear that that's the only way, and because it is that partial funding of it. Whereas there are other ways, and maybe that's something for a potential business opportunity, of doing private kind of mentoring. It doesn't matter where you are. If you haven't got one of those programs, you can still get some of that mentoring and some of that facilitation.
Yeah.
That could be an interesting looking at the difference between private and kind of subsidized, because there'll be so many people that be wanting it but not necessarily getting enough of it. So, but you don't want to have to pay for it, because you shouldn't have to pay for it. It should be supplied as part of the profession. And one of the other questions that looking at, and one of the discussions I've had lately with a few people, is to do with funding, but actually not with training, putting it reverse and putting it, giving the women funding so they can choose their model of care. So if we actually kind of enabled them to choose their model of care, would that then kick even more places into having midwifery group practice type models if there was much greater demand, because the women were actually in control of the money?
Yeah, that's right. And I know that the Australian College of Midwives there in South Australia did a wonderful package of raising the visibility of midwifery to the public through things on buses and whatnot.
Yes, it was quite fun driving past, driving behind a bus with one of my students on the back of it. It was just kind of like,
So, I think the potential, what I worry about is that the women don't have enough knowledge to make choices. And the ones that do are the, you know, sort of educated women who have the knowledge and also have the funds. I feel like there's a big group of socially disadvantaged and even our Indigenous women who don't have access to the best care. And, I'd really like to see a big shift in those women having access to the best, you know, continuity of care, midwifery and continuity of care.
It's quite sad that, like, in the UK, the women who are pregnant, they just go to a midwife. There's, like, no second thoughts about who else they're going to see. They know they're going to go talk to a midwife first.
Yeah.
Too many here in Australia, it's like they don't think of a midwife. It goes to their GP that refers them to a clinic or refers them to an obstetrician. And it's like, why have we become so medicalised? Why have we lost that? We've got so many other things that are based on the UK models, Westminster and all that stuff. Why have we changed in this one system and lost that visibility and lost that ability to make that first contact? Because I think it was Jane Sandhill that said that every woman needs a midwife, but only some women need a doctor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what I think about that is I think it's our funding. So even though we have Medicare as a universal health insurance system, which is great and equitable, you need to have a provider number.
Yep.
And so for women to access Medicare, you need a provider number. So only a very small number of endorsed midwives have a provider number, and they work in private practice. They're not generally working in a you know, what do you call it, Medicare-only setting. So in that sense, women have to go under an obstetrician who they'll never see, and they'll only see midwives through their pregnancy journey. But unless we increase or give midwives provider numbers, then that's what we're going to see. I mean, the other thing is, in the UK, they do have midwives attached to general practices, to GPs. So I feel like that's another avenue, is that we attach midwives with the GP, but the GP needs to let go of the midwife.
Yeah.
So in the UK, it's the GP says to midwife, oh, you need to see her, she's pregnant. So, yeah, I'll see the person with chickenpox, you see the person who's pregnant. And I feel like that's what we need to do in Australia. Currently, this whole GP shared care is about, you know, shifting the funds from state maternity services to federal maternity services, so that Medicare covers women's antenatal care, but the state's responsible for their intrapartum care. And it's just, shifting funds,
It would be interesting if we could bring in, I know we've got conversations at higher levels about bringing in graduates when they graduate to a level to have prescribing rights, same as what New Zealand able to have their graduates. it would be really interesting, the conversations that we are going to have over the next few years to fight for that to be accepted more, because I know at the moment it's been put in a too hard basket because of a lot of the competing stakeholders want to have their say. How would that change in Australia, do you think, if we were able to go to a model? Because more midwives would be able to then be able to go into independent practice, but we've got an insurance issue in Australia as well, same as kind of I think globally is an insurance issue for birthing. But would that help us get more group practices, or does it still come back to the hospitals and still come back to kind of the funding and that overarching, you need an obstetrician to kind of say it's okay to run a centre?
No, absolutely. I think prescribing is critical.
Yeah.
And it was in the draft AMMAC standards and then it got canned. So I think that prescribing is critical and midwives do it anyway. Mm. You know, I was trying to explain to some people who are interested in cervical screening, how do midwives order the pathology? And I say, they have standing audits. They just send the sample off and it is under the doctor of the day or whoever their woman is associated with. No, they're not prescribing, but they're actually determining the test and they're sending off for the test. They know what test their scope of knowledge and is, and their scope of practice is to know what test to order when. And if it's not, then they need to consult and refer. And we have very clear national guidelines, the Australian College of Midwives guidelines for that. So I think they're already doing it. Mm. And as far as, you know, things like there's very little medication that we use, but the things that we do use, oxytocin and so on, we use it on standing orders. So we are prescribing again.
Yeah.
So I think prescribing is critical. Insurance for intrapartum care is critical, and also provider numbers for Medicare. Mm.
So another question. We know that I think in Australia about 7-8% of women have access to a continuity of care model, midwifery group practice model.
Yeah, well, that's another area for research, because that study by Dawson was done in 2016. So it's getting old now.
It is.
Except the Australian College of Midwives did a survey in 2020 about, it was related to COVID, but they asked the women who completed this survey what model of care they had, and similarly 8% of those women who responded to the survey said that they had midwifery continuity care. So, look, and we can tell by the hospitals that we know, there's less midwives working in continuity than there is in standard care. So it's sort of, So what was the question?
I was setting it up. How do we take, and this is what I talk to my students all about, because they all want to work in midwifery group practice as kind of like top standard. We know it's there. They get excited about doing it. Reality hits. There's not enough jobs in those places for them to do. Then they feel like they're forced to work in the hospital tertiary settings that doesn't have that same environment.
Yeah.
How can we take some of the critical elements of continuity of care, how do we take that and actually make the hospital system better whilst we're working for a complete overhaul of the system?
I don't know. Look, it's what, and I've just published a paper on this, but it's controversial and I'm not that happy about it. But how health systems are responding are introducing this antenatal postnatal service. And I feel like that is missing the essential ingredient of relationship at the time of birth, intrapartum care. So, so we know that full continuity care, you know, improves all the intrapartum things.
Yep.
So if you take that out of it, if you take intrapartum out of it, and what I've started to find in the post-implementation study is that women or the midwives are saying, well, you know, what if I prepare her for birth and then she gets there and the first noise she makes, they say, do you want an epidural? So I feel like services go, full continuity care is too hard.
Yep.
So let's just do this, they call it MAPS.
MAPS.
Yeah. Well, that's what they call it in New South Wales. I don't know what they call it elsewhere.
And what does that stand for?
Well, I thought it stood for midwifery, antenatal and postnatal service.
Yeah.
But I've been told it's maternity, antenatal, postnatal service. So.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's to include GPs. So it's even diluting continuity even more. So, however, I did find that it is acceptable to women and it's acceptable to midwives, you know, who are one service, who are thinking about, implementing it. So
how do you, I mean, when you're looking at the benefits of continuity of care, we know that it's not just about the kind of the mortality. We know that the little changes that come across make the big changes postnatally, especially within birth trauma and expectations and the reality versus what they think of, that having that experience, but being there for the birth and being able to kind of be that contact with them and then follow through with the informal debriefing or the formal debriefing. How do you kind of then how would you then evaluate this new service? Because you'd have to be looking at, well, what the rates of potentially birth trauma and what are the rates of satisfaction? And does it come down to the individual midwives who they just happen to get when they're actually rostered on for that shift?
Yeah.
Because that's the, you're comparing completely different services that are being marked up, but it's not the same service at all.
No, it's not. And I just think they're going, oh, we can't do full continuity, but we'll do some. And it's like, well, no, I don't think that's correct.
You might as well just stay going into the clinics, the pre-clinics beforehand, and just have the same midwife for half of your visits.
Yeah, well, we used to call them midwives clinics.
Yeah.
But interestingly, in Scotland when I was there, they they call caseload, and I'd say, all right, that's great. Yeah, we have a caseload antenatally and postnatally. I said, what about birth? Oh, no, we don't do that. They go to the hospital for their births. And it was only the community midwives who did it. And then they even said, well, what's the definition of continuity? And I said, oh, my God, it's in the systematic review. It's so clear.
Continuity throughout the whole thing. Is it just that we're fighting the system? I mean, does it come down to a gender issue? Does it come down to patriarchal? Does it come down, like, we've got so much evidence to show that continuity of care works?
It definitely comes down to the medicalization of childbirth.
Yeah.
It definitely comes down to the medical colleagues who are threatened. We are threatening 30% of pregnant women in this country will go to a private obstetrician for continuity. They're threatening their their careers, their livelihood, and so there is resistance and there is power associated with those obstetricians who are resisting it. So, which is a shame, because we should be working collaboratively
together. Absolutely.
Because every midwife, what is it? Every woman needs a midwife. Some women will need an obstetrician.
Yeah.
And when the midwife is with that woman who needs an obstetrician, we need to be able to collaborate in a collegial manner. Yeah.
And there are some brilliant obstetricians out there who are helping push the lead for midwifery care and the fact that, no, you've got this, fine, just call me if you really need me.
Yeah.
Like, there's some fantastic ones out there, but it's also, and it seems to be once you get up into policy level of making those big changes that you've got, I know that the midwifery, we're kind of keep pushing on against it and get the reputation of we're just very loud women who keep kind of banging on about things. And it's like, but we have to change the system. Because otherwise we're never going to change that system.
Yeah. And also to inspire the others.
Yep.
You know, the younger ones who are coming up and through, younger in midwifery years. I mean, as you know yourself, they're not always younger women, but they're younger in midwifery years. So, yeah.
And I think that was a really kind of heartwarming thing that was reading the State of the Midwifery World Report in April when that came out, was, yes, we need more midwives. We're going to have a massive shortage. We've got a massive impact that we can have over the next kind of like 10 years on lives. But it's not just clinical midwives. We also need the educators, but we also need the governance. We need the policy writers. We need midwifery at every single level of the conversation at every single table, which is why it's so exciting that Jane Sandhauer has got the first midwifery research national position. We've still got, we're still fighting for a chief midwife in Australia to have that recognition that maybe this decade of midwifery research that the ICM have kind of like called, I'm excited to look at 2030 and then look back and see the changes that midwifery has made and to see how many midwives are sitting at those tables.
Yeah, that's a nice idea, actually. Yeah, I'll look forward to that as well. And the other thing the State of the World Midwifery says that it has to be a well-organised maternity service with continuity of midwifery care.
Yep.
But there has to be a referral processes for women who need it. So, yeah, that's another really important thing, well-organised, yeah.
And I think that's, I don't know if people are afraid that we're, and we're talking about imaging of midwives, and last night we had a state ACM meeting and somebody was saying, oh, the image of midwives some people have is just sitting down chanting, singing Kumbhala and incense and waiting for a woman to give birth. But it's like, why are we, we're not saying we don't want this to work together. We're not saying that we want to go out on ourselves. We want to say, we're trying to say that we're the leaders in physiological birth. Let us do that. And when we need to, we're definitely going to call out and bring in the mental health, the dietitians, the kind of psychologists, the psychiatrists and the obstetricians when we need to, because women have got existing lives around the pregnancies.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
So going back to doing your PhD, so doing sharing a table with teenagers, doing their homework.
Yeah.
Is it a bit kind of like deja vu at the moment in lockdown?
Oh, no, it's much, no, because this is work. PhD was study. It's, I found it very rewarding to do this study. That's not to say it wasn't hard.
Yep.
But it was, once you figure out you're learning how to do research, it becomes easier.
Yep.
But when you're thinking, oh, why can't I do this? I don't know how to do this. This is really frustrating me. Then, especially when you are clever in other areas, and then all of a sudden you're like, which everyone doing a PhD is, you realise, hold on, this is new and I need to be like a year one PhD student and embrace the learning. Once I learnt it and once I got it, it was, it was really good. But, yeah, we, you know, used to laugh when I would get back, you know, like reams of work and get back and think, oh, I can keep one sentence. And,
Yeah,
great start was my supervisor's. Great start. I'm like, what do you mean start? I thought I'd finished it.
And it's like, it's that kind of taking that hat off from being like a clinician or an academic and you put the student hat on and go, no, they're doing this to help me.
Yeah.
It's to help make me better. It's not an attack, but there's an awful lot of red there, but it's not an attack. It's going to make myself better. And when you look back on it, you sit there and kind of go, oh, my God, was that what I was writing to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. the learning that occurs. Mm. Yeah, it's good.
How did you keep your sanity through it all? So working full-time, having to deal with family, having to deal with all your normal responsibilities.
Yeah.
We know that the rates of mental health within kind of higher education in particular, and we know that within your PhD there are moments when everyone rocks in the corner, there are moments when everyone goes, I just can't do this anymore, and there are multiple tears shed for both happiness and sadness and frustration and joy. So how did you keep yourself going when you were doing your PhD?
That's a really good question. I got very good at compartmentalizing the work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have my teaching Monday to Thursday. Fridays I would devote to my PhD, particularly in the end when I was writing. Earlier in the data collection, I had to mix it up a bit and it was really hard because I was doing interviews and whatnot. And I was like, oh, but she needs to talk to me now, so I'll do that and I'll go over there and this, that, and I would have got a class then and I've got marking and, you know, and you do all that. I never did it at night at home. So mm-hmm. I was there for my family, you know, which was basically cooking dinner and cleaning up. But it was about being present, being in yep. the kitchen, being there, available, listening to them. And then so it was really much, pretty much Fridays and Saturdays for 4 years.
Yep.
That I just, you know, devoted to working on it. Yeah, regular meetings with my supervisor, self-talk about when you get back or that, you know, great start and you want to cry and say, no, I've finished, you don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. It's
learning that she's got the knowledge and the skill yep. and that it'll strengthen the work. Mm. And the one point where I did cry was I had written, I did okay with the findings. So it was like the data collection and writing out the findings was so exciting.
Yeah.
But the discussion, which always is the hardest, it's the hardest in a paper, mm. 3,000 words, it's hard. Yes. And so I wrote that discussion, chapter 8, and I gave it to my supervisor. And a few days later she came back and she said, I've read this before, start again. And it was, she said, you've just recapped your findings. I don't get the so what.
Yep.
How are you going to change yep. the world? This is the bit. You're going to change the world. And I went, oh. And so I was at that point I just thought, you know what, I'm not going to do this. I don't need to do this.
Yep.
I'm not going to do it. But then I thought about it and I took myself back to the very reason that I did the, what was the driver for me doing the yep. research? I wanted to change it. So how was I going to do it? So that's how I came up with the conceptual model, which is sort of a toolkit or a recipe, how to do this. How do you move new graduates into continuity of care? And now I've done it. It seems so simple, but no one else is doing it. So only a few people are doing it. I should qualify. A few people are doing it. So that's good. Yeah.
So that's the model that you've got in your paper that has the essential components in the centre
yeah.
and then the new graduate responsibilities on one side and the manager's responsibilities on the other side. So you can actually see that there is responsibilities that the new graduates have to stand up and actually look for it. They have to be proactive in their own development.
Yeah.
And they have to have that stepping into that conversation. They can't stay the wallflower. They yeah. have to be that they're there to participate, but then you've got to do that in, you can only do that in an environment where you actually feel that safety and that supportiveness, which yeah. is where the managers come in to actually provide that environment and to provide that safety net almost to say, yep, we know you're going to step out on that branch, but we're actually here to catch you. And each time you do that, we're actually got that branch is going to get stronger.
Yeah. And actually they don't fall.
No.
They don't fall. This is the thing. Everyone thinks they're going to fall off the branch, and they don't.
So where does that mentality come from, do you think?
I think it comes from our risk-averse maternity service where we have a system of negligence and blame. When something goes wrong, people sue. And I feel like that's where it comes from. And I think that no one goes to work to harm
yep.
anyone, and that sadly, adverse events and critical incidents do occur, and usually it's a system failure. It's rarely down to one individual. Mm. And you know, if you did an analysis, no, I don't think anyone had, I don't know if anyone's done it, but I don't think it would be just new graduates.
No.
I think it happens too, but if there's a new graduate in continuity care and the woman has a postpartum hemorrhage or something happens, that new graduate will be pulled out.
Yep.
And that's what's wrong with our system.
And I remember doing, because I was doing, involved in some research years ago now when MET calls were being brought in, initially oh, yeah. being brought in, so a medical emergency team. So instead of waiting for the patient to collapse or have an arrest, there's a nice criteria that is if you're worried about, and I love the last one, is if you're worried about them, call the MET team. Well, we were finding, though, that some people were not wanting to escalate it because they'd escalated it before when they weren't sure because they didn't have that advanced knowledge in that situation. They weren't getting the responses from the home team doctors that they were trying to get to come and review as patients. So they'd escalated it correctly to a MET call. But when the team had come, somebody was having a really grumpy day and bollocks them for calling the team. And it's like, well, you should have gone through your home team. And that stopped them from escalating in the future when they should have.
And so, I know what you mean, yeah.
And so that kind of cascading effect is if we stop blaming,
yeah,
kind of, and if people weren't going, oh, I want, and I did it the other day. One of my colleagues kind of said, oh, Liz, if you've got a couple of minutes, can I catch up with you? And I went, yep, no worries. The first thing is, what have I stuffed up? It's your first point of call is I've done something wrong. And it's like, yeah, no, you haven't. I just want to ask you a question. But if that's what new graduates are going to feel like, every time they kind of go, look, I'm not sure, I want to check, and the response is, oh, what now? Then, yeah, we have to change that whole system, that whole attitude.
Yeah, I used to say always, you know, call me. I don't care if you call me. If you call me and all I have to say is you're doing the right thing, there's no harm done. And yeah, they did, and they always had the right answer. And the other thing was, if you call the whatever the team is called, Met, or you know, the red button or whatever, and the team arrive and there's no emergency, isn't it great? You can offer them a cup of tea.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's a great thing. That's a great outcome rather than not calling and the deteriorating woman is, you know, the big thing. Oh, she was deteriorating and they didn't call. So, yeah.
And that's, I think that's part of the larger environment when you're talking about systemic failures, because you're also talking about staff who are doing double shifts, you've got staff who are not getting enough kind of holiday time, you've got staff who have got, well, a whole pile of other issues happening around the world at the moment, especially with kind of you guys in lockdown. But there's so many other things that take away your concentration. And when we do look at those risk analysis, but also look at those postmortems of events that do happen, that there are so many little things that could have been changed but weren't, because of cost saving or because of lacking of staff, or people are afraid to put reports in of near misses. And therefore we don't have the evidence to say, this is what the situation is. This is a consequence of it. Oh, no, you don't have to report that. You don't have to report that, because if you report it, you then get blamed for it.
Yeah, instead of, using it as a system level shift.
Yeah.
Which is what, you know, what we started talking about at the beginning is this whole COVID thing, and the hospitals are saying, no, we can't accept anymore because it's now not safe. So, and that's a good thing,
Which is a frightening thought. You sit there and go through all the kind of coloured codes, and this is what your coloured codes are and your internal, and then you sit down and go, yeah, hopefully you'll never meet one of them, and yet now we're having it, that people are kind of getting to that level far too frequently, really.
Yeah.
In the world. Okay, let's go to happier news. How did you celebrate?
How did I celebrate? I don't even remember. It's quite a few years ago. But how did I celebrate? Well, oh, I know how I celebrated. So we used to have a thing that when you go to graduation and you wear the gown, and you're sitting on, as an academic, and you sit on the stage and you watch everyone come up, you can't see what they're wearing. All you can see is their shoes.
Okay,
And actually I was on a trip in Paris with my husband, and I said I need a pair of Christian Louboutin shoes, the red-soled shoes. And he said, yes, I'm going to buy them for you. Now, this is a great story, actually, Liz. I'll quickly tell you. Years ago, when I was working in continuity of care, I read the Sydney Morning Herald one Saturday morning that said, the women in New York City who wear red-soled shoes are getting privately practicing midwives because they don't want to go to the gynecologist. And I went, what are red-soled shoes? They sound very fancy. And I looked them up, and they're Christian Louboutin shoes, and they're gorgeous and super expensive.
Yes.
And I would never, ever buy those. Anyway, we were in Paris, and I said, yes, let's go shopping. And this was our last day in Paris. And so it was Sunday. And in Paris, the shops are shut on Sunday because it's Catholic. And anyway, we found, I can't remember the name of the department store, we found it. And we walked in and we couldn't, it was so expensive. It was open on Sunday. So expensive. We couldn't, Bon Marche. And we couldn't afford anything in there. And I said, come on, let's just go. They don't have the shoes. And then we walked around the corner and there was the Christian Louboutin stand. Got the shoes, wore them to graduation. They killed my feet.
Yes.
And I've never worn them again, or I think I've worn them once, and they are absolutely so uncomfortable. So red sock shoes that come in little red felt bags inside the beautiful box in the gorgeous bag. The packaging was worth it, and they sit in my wardrobe. That was my celebration.
Just frame them. Frame them alongside your PhD.
Yeah, good. Good, yeah.
I must admit, as an academic doing graduation, I do like looking at the shoes.
Yeah, that's all there is to that.
It's the entertaining. And yeah. You sit there and go, how can you walk in that? And I think there's an inverse proportional height for undergraduate, postgraduate. So the higher you get, the smaller your heels get.
Yeah.
And the flatter your heels get. Thank you very much for your time.
That's lovely.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.